The Foreign Area Officer podcast is not an official audio production. The views shared in the recordings are the personal views of the interviewee and the host. They are for informational purposes only and not necessarily those of the Department of Defense or its components. The United States Department of Defense and the United States Army make no endorsement of its content. Hello, everyone. This is Michael Hill with the Foreign Area Officer Podcast. Today, my guests are Major Matt Saunders and his wife, Dr. Maddie Saunders. Matt is an infantry officer and Latin America FAO, currently earning his master's degree at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He is a Spanish speaker and completed his IRT at U.S. Embassy Mexico City. Dr. Madison Saunders is a practicing clinical audiologist. She earned her Bachelor's of Arts in Communication Sciences and Disorders from LSU in 2012 and her Doctorate of Audiology from the University of Kansas Medical Center in 2017. Welcome to Major Matt and Dr. Maddie Saunders, who are here with us today on the FAO podcast. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Matt, you and I met a couple years ago when you showed up in Mexico as an IRT officer to replace Derek Rep. And you had, for me, what was one of the most unique FAO IRT experiences because you saw every country in the AOR, if I'm not mistaken. And Maddie, you went along with him every step of the way. So what, tell us a little bit about what was that experience like and what did you get out of it?
Thanks, Mike. IRT was pretty awesome. It's hard to describe how much you could possibly see and like what things that you're able to learn. And there's a lot of incidental learning, I think, that comes from the experience, either from planning how to get into each country, coordinating with all the leaders that work in every individual mission and team for each country team. But overall, I thought this was like one of the most like profound experiences we've ever had, both as an officer personally or professionally, but also as a person as well.
I think everyone looks back on the IRT experiences, either a turning point or one of those times in their lives when they've really been able to do things that they've wanted to do for a long time and really develop themselves by seeing as much as they can and by meeting as many people as they can. And I think that's one thing that I didn't do enough on IRT was focus on people. But I know that was something that you focused on, meeting people and building relationships with people that you were hoping to work with later.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the trademarks for FAO community is our networking and getting an opportunity, particularly within Latin America, for you to start building your brand, start reaching out to leaders that you're probably going to end up working with or working for down the road, and to start learning about the unique problems that they face within their respective countries and then how you leverage those lessons learned to other experiences that you have. It was very impressive. You'll encounter a problem that one country team is dealing with, and then you'll come across another country team that's dealing with something very similar, and you'll feel very compelled to want to reach out to somebody and ask them, hey, how would you negotiate X, Y, and Z? And you start realizing how powerful and impactful the FAO community is by developing strong, robust networks.
You mentioned unique problems. Is there anything that stands out in your mind?
One of the things I remember when we were going to Argentina is I remember how the SCO office is trying to stand up an SF team to work with the SCO mission that's down there. And I know that a lot of country teams are going to fall into already having these systems established the same way as having a status of forces agreement. And I realize that's a very unique experience. Not every single FAO is going to have the opportunity to build that from the ground. So I immediately remembered Colonel Florjan and want to reach out to him if I ever come across a similar situation in any country team that I'm assigned. Thinking about what would be a unique experience that a FAO would have, and remembering which leaders within the community have dealt with these problems beforehand, and knowing who you can reach out to in the future if you ever deal with something similar.
100% agree. Knowing who you can reach out to is one of the hardest parts as a FAO, and sometimes even just as an officer in general. How have you been able to do that with officers you've met on IRT? Have you continued to reach out to them and keep you up with them?
Yeah. You develop an extended family. And I think Maddie's definitely more of our networker with all the families that we continue to come across. But you get really invested in their story and what they're doing. And even whenever you branch off to start doing your graduate school studies, you'll start reaching out to one another and asking about like the different things that you're learning, or sometimes ask for a peer review on a project or some kind of takeaway that you may have gotten from your IRT experience that you can lend to their research. I'm very impressed that every stage of the MELD4 pipeline, you get more and more exposure to more officers within the community, and you get more buy-in to wanting to follow what they're doing and what assignments they're going to proceed on and wanting to stay in contact with those folks.
Awesome. 100% agree. And Maddie, what was that experience like for you to be able to travel around and see the entirety of Latin America from United States all the way down to, I think you guys even went down to Patagonia and spent some time down there, right?
Yeah, we made it all the way to Ushuaia, which is their claim to fame is the world's most
southern city, the end of the world.
There are some settlements that are
further south,
but none that have the population size as big as it. They get away with it by saying that they're the most southern city. Gathering of people, I guess.
That's fair.
I actually have our master
spreadsheet, so I could spout off a few numbers for you if you are interested or care.
Yeah, that'd be great.
We went to 19 countries over 32 weeks.
10 trips in 10 and a half months. And these are all 2 week long, sometimes 3 week long trips, right?
Yeah. Our shortest trip was just
a week, maybe.
We did some travel within Mexico.
Our longest trip
was 5 weeks. And that was our
5 weeks
Brazil trip, I think. It's been a little while.
Paraguay.
That was one trip for both
one
Brazil and Paraguay?
One trip was Brazil-Paraguay, yeah.
Okay.
You have to duplicate as many visits with different countries on singular trips because you have to be very economical with the resources that you have and try to maximize the utility of every single trip. I would love if we had a time to reset every single time we went to a country, but you have to maximize those opportunities to minimize the airfare and other transportation costs.
Something that I would definitely like to mention is that this sounds like we accomplished this great thing, which we definitely did, but there are pros and cons to every person's IRT experience. While we can say we've been to almost every single Latin American country, we did
19 countries in
10 months and all of that, it, like Matt mentioned, it did come with the trade-off of we weren't as able to get as close to
Mission
Mexico families as maybe some other people who didn't travel as much. We were building a relationship with his cohort that was all over the world, but not necessarily the ODC team in Mexico. There's always the trade-off there. And also, I am very aware that not every family can do this. I was fortunate enough to be able to take a sabbatical from clinical care for a year. I planned a lot of our trip while Matt facilitated a lot of the financing and the paperwork behind it. We made a good team, which made us be able to do and see a lot of awesome things that really strengthened our language skills, our cultural competencies. It allowed Matt to interview for different jobs, but I don't think that it's reasonable to tell everyone this is what you should all strive for. You should all be trying to get to 19 countries or whatever. I know that's not a reasonable expectation. It was doable for our family and we did it, but there were trade-offs. I don't know if I would change it for anything because it was quite an experience, but boy, were we tired at the end of it for sure.
Yeah, when I did my IRT, what I calculated was that I traveled 42% of the time, which for me seemed like a lot. My predecessor traveled, I think I calculated between 49 and 52% of the time, which I didn't feel like I got that far, but I knew I could have done more. I would guess that you guys, you said 10 trips in 10 months. That's almost 80% of the time that you were assigned to Mission Mexico. You guys were out traveling and doing exactly what IRT is meant for. And that is building that relationship, seeing other militaries, and especially building your name and your brand within your cohort. And with some of the senior leaders.
Yeah.
I think you guys did it absolutely right.
Next.
I wanted to ask you, how difficult or easy was that to take a sabbatical? Has that been difficult to turn it off and turn it on again?
Difficult, yes. Doable, also yes. I am a clinical audiologist, so I'm an ear doctor for anyone who doesn't know what audiology is, because a lot of people don't. I was working full-time when Matt V-tipped from infantry to FEA. I quit my job at the time to go to DLI with him and do the Spanish immersion program as a spouse when we found out that we were moving to Mexico and that due to their SOFA agreement, I wouldn't legally be able to work there. Also, the field of audiology and the specialty of hearing healthcare doesn't really
exist
much in Latin America at all. It's definitely a developing
profession.
So in preparing for IRT, at the embassy clinic. Yeah, and looking into what
the next decade of
our FAO life together would look like with my career, I pivoted again, and I'm like currently getting my master's of public health to widen my skill set to be That's able great. To work in global health and humanitarian health while we're abroad, if we end up in a place where clinical audiology does not exist. So that's what we're doing right now. But while we're in Boston, I'm working at a hospital where I actually did
my residency.
So it's some people that I know, some familiar faces, familiar setting. It's refreshing. Oh, we don't really get that in the military sometimes to go back.
Absolutely. And it's good to reset and re-engage with your career field and the community.
Absolutely. I'm
sure, and get some more clinical time under the belt. And you talked a little bit about being in DLI, and that's something that I wish more spouses would take advantage of. Mm-hmm. Everybody's situation is different. So how was that experience for you as a spouse going through DLI?
So I would say similar to your wife, I don't think that I thought about it as, oh, great, I've always wanted to learn Spanish, or I've always wanted to learn another language. That was nowhere on my radar. But the way that I looked at it was very similar to other education. I
had to get to
be an audiologist. Is that I have to do this. No one is going to pay me to be in the hearing healthcare profession in Latin America if I can't speak Spanish. So
that's fair.
That was the perspective that I was coming from. I'm a very type A person, if you can't tell from all the spreadsheets that I've mentioned, but this was like, put it on the checklist. I have to learn Spanish. I have to have proficiency, not only to support Matt and to be able to live abroad, but also a little bit selfishly for myself too, of I love my profession. I love working in hearing healthcare, and I can't continue to do that if I don't do this first. I told Matt once we started and we were like in it, I was in a different class than him. They separated us into different classes, and we were talking about how challenging it is. DLI is an extremely
academically
challenging environment, especially if you go in with little to no experience in that language. And I was telling him that it felt like I was getting my doctorate again. That was the same like level of academic rigor that they were putting us through. And I was not prepared for that again. In my 30s, I was not prepared for that.
Something that was a positive externality of Maddie going to a separate course is the MPEP over at the Uruguay War College was in Maddie's class. So like when we made our trip down to Uruguay, we already had connections. We already had other extended FAO family for us to go visit, even though it was Navy and they're going to get assigned to, I think they're currently assigned over in Italy right now. It was an interesting way for us to also expand, you know, the network as well and get to know other people.
What was interesting too is some of the
representatives that came to support FAMEX were also in Maddie's cohort. I never would have met them beforehand if it wasn't Maddie attending this other class. And so whenever I saw them in Mexico, we already had an immediate rapport, and he was already asking like, hey, how's Maddie doing? Did she find a job? What's she doing currently? So it was a cool experience to also meet with these other individuals, even though it was through a secondhand kind of connection later in Latin America.
I think the fact that Maddie did that and created additional connections with people that, Matt, you didn't necessarily have a one-on-one connection with through class, it brought those people into your circle and made them a part of your story. So Maddie, you talked a little bit too about when Matt was applying for FAO. So what did you think when he was applying for this job? Did you have a good understanding of what it meant and what it entailed and what the expectations were?
I don't think anyone knows any of those things when they're about to be FAO. There's no frame of reference for it. We came from very traditional operational line unit infantry type of world. Everyone and all of our friends were in that world. I just started to feel very comfortable in that world, knowing all the acronyms and timelines and sequences and patch chart rotations and all of that jazz. And then coming into the FAO community, you feel not bottom of the totem pole, but you feel lost again. It's like we just started.
It's like you're starting out as a lieutenant again.
Exactly. It's like going to eyeball, like, and learning what all these acronyms mean and figuring out what's next and all this kind of stuff. Everything is new. All the systems, all the admin, all the just the world of State Department in general, I think is wild and like a maze. But it's been interesting, to say the least. We definitely had no idea what we were getting in for. I think Jay Fayok, I always tell the story about when we were sitting at Jay Fayok and Matt had just ETIPped and we had just moved to Monterey 4 days before Jay Fayok started. Our timeline just worked out that way. And we're sitting in the first talk and it was like general or someone very high ranking or maybe an ambassador. I'm not really sure. And he was giving a talk and it was when all the FAOs, the newly V-tipped FAOs and their spouses were all together. And he said something about welcome everyone. I'm so glad to see so many spouses here and the importance of family and spouses like to a FAO and this lifestyle in general, which I do definitely agree with. And he was like, but if your wife or your spouse is a doctor or a lawyer or really anyone who needs a license to practice, probably not in the right place. And I just remember like slowly turning and looking at Matt and being like, what did you do? And he's just like sitting, looking straight ahead, like vigorously writing notes, pretending that he doesn't know that I'm just like glaring at him.
Yep. I was full on T-Rex defense. If I don't move, make any sudden movements, I'll be fine.
Yeah, that was a fun thing to realize after it's too late. But I don't think we wouldn't go back if we could. We're happy where we're at. And someone joked the other day, because Matt and I had done a lot of traveling before he V-tipped and we don't have any kids. And so that's where all of our disposable income goes to pretty much is travel. And one of our friends who's not in the military said, it seems like you've figured out a way to get the military to pay for the lifestyle you wanted to live anyway. And I was like, yeah, we did finally. After like back-to-back deployments and infantry life, I feel like we're settled now in a good place for us.
Yeah, if you're looking forward to traveling, FAO is the best way to do
sure.
it.
Sure.
That there's no secret there, I think.
Now, it might be stressful diplomatic travel, but you'll do it.
But
you'll
see travel.
It. Yeah, travel nonetheless.
And on our end, my wife really doesn't like travel at all. She likes to stay in one place and she likes to be at home where she feels comfortable. But I love to travel. And so this is a happy medium
sure.
where we get to travel places and she gets to stay home wherever we go. And I get to go out and do the travels
there
that I
go.
Need and,
win-win.
And some of them that I want. Yeah, win-win for us. It doesn't always work out that way, but sometimes it's a win for everybody.
Yeah.
And so Matt, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your transition to FAO and how you learned about the branch and what is it that really lit that spark for you to want to join up in this community?
Yeah, I continued to do the things that the Army wanted me to do. And I was, by nature, very adherent to DAPAM 600-3 and wanted to be that well-rounded infantry officer. And I was on track to continue to pursue like the aspirations to be a tactical battalion commander. And that's where I was aiming my career to be or my career to focus on. But I kept having these really cool opportunities whenever I was initially a lieutenant and one of my first deployments over to the Horn of Africa, the work with the Combined Joint Task Force and working with the French and the Djiboutian Gendarmerie Marie and then planning live fires with the Japanese Ground Defense Force that was there. I was like, man, this is really awesome. I really enjoy this experience working with partner forces and building these joint capacities. And I didn't have the vocabulary to really describe what this experience was. I just knew that I wanted to pursue things like that similarly in later down the road. And then whenever I later was assigned over in Hawaii, we were working with PACOM and getting the opportunity to go plan bilateral live fires as well as situational training exercises with the Australians and the Japanese again. I started having a better understanding of this is what I really want to do. I really want to find ways to continue to work with partner nations. Still have no idea like how to make this a career track. I had no real idea of what the FAO community was. So later when I finally got assigned to Human Resources Command and I was serving as a career manager for infantry lieutenants, very rarely I would get a question from like an infantry lieutenant that would ask me about the FAO pipeline and FAO track. And I felt obligated for me to learn as much about the Army as I could so I could be the best career manager possible and try to coach guys onto what things they need to consider and look at. And that's whenever I walked down the hall, I went over to Operations Support Division. I ran into Brennan Parker, who's a future readiness officer for FAO branch at the time. Asked him if I could schedule a sit down and learn more about his branch and like what things I should be telling lieutenants. And after we started that initial conversation, I got really convinced that this is what I wanted to do. And it first started off as like a information seeking endeavor. And eventually it started becoming more selfish. And we started scheduling more meetings for me to learn more and more about what the FAO community is. And I think eventually Brennan, Maddie and I, we all scheduled a talk virtually during COVID where we can talk about like seriously applying and submitting a VTIP packet. And that's when we made the final decision that this is what we wanted to do. So I would say I probably had a very traditional career track, had some awesome highlights throughout the different deployments, get exposure to what things like the FAO community does. And whenever I learned about the FAO community in greater detail, that's whenever I became convinced that this is what I want to do as a career.
You mentioned before that you didn't think that your story was very unique, but I disagree with that. I think you have had some really interesting experiences that have pushed you on to being a FAO and led you in the right direction. And one of those that you and I have talked about before was your experience in Djibouti. And so just to be clear, that was something that you did before you joined up on FAO branch, right? That wasn't something you did as a FAO. It was something as an infantry officer that you were sent over there to work with.
Yeah, that's right.
And you told me a story once of an experience you had working with the gendarmerie over there and some of the issues they were having with people penetrating the perimeter fence of the airport and how the decisions that you made and the way things turned out maybe wasn't the way you thought it should have, even though it ended up being the right thing for Task Force. So I don't know if I'm getting that story, but I remember you telling me when we were talking in Mexico, that was a decision point for you on how our actions impact the lives of others unintentionally by managing or promoting security for U.S. forces.
It's funny. Djibouti was such an awesome experience, but there were so many mistakes that I made where I also grew significantly as a professional as well. But what you're referencing is I remember when we were serving down in Djibouti and I was working at Shibeli Airfield, many of the local Djiboutians would travel down to Somalia and they would trade in their goats and then they would use the money to buy cosmetics, Viagra, and different products. And they would go back to Djibouti City and they would sell those. But there was not a lot of electricity that was in Djibouti. So the point of reference that they used was the airfield to navigate. So they would walk almost directly up to this airfield that we were defending with the Air Force, and they would dogleg around the flight line, and they would proceed all the way to Djibouti City. And I remember I was very tactically minded as a young lieutenant. I was concerned about Al-Shabaab, and I was concerned about all these risks of potential attacks. And so we looked at how do we partner with the gendarmerie to try to interdict or delay these movements from these smugglers, presenting them as this is a threat, not necessarily considering that this is a way in which many Djiboutians are trying to just make a livelihood and survive and support their families. So when the gendarmerie came out and they positioned themselves where they made themselves almost a net to capture or interdict these smugglers, and it led to a lot of non-hostile crossings across our perimeter, and that led to a huge mess, both with the Horn of Africa as well as locally with our own mission. And I realized then that there's more to solving these problems than tactical solutions. And I didn't take the time or energy to get really spun up on the political background, the socioeconomics of the region that I was in. And I realized that there was a lot more tools to promoting U.S. interests than just the tactical arsenal that we trained for, we knew about. So that's whenever I started getting more convinced that I needed to start being a well-read professional, not only with the mission that I'm assigned, but also understanding all the different contexts and the different resources that I can use to address different problems. Now, for the most part, our integration with the Gendarmerie was seen as this huge joint win or in regards to this task force that we're building. And I thought we definitely made some great progress into building these efforts, but we didn't necessarily communicate exactly what we needed from them or how we can best shape each other's operations so we can be mutually supportive and not create turbulence within the local community.
And do you feel like in the end, the U.S. effort was successful there in developing a strategy to address those issues?
I'm not sure. I know that the security posture was much better after we left. I knew that a lot of these concerns and major things that AFRICOM was worried about in regards to Shipelli Airfield, I think we did a great job addressing those. I think that the partner relationship now exists, and we definitely broke a lot of glass getting that underway. And I would be very curious if I ever went back to Djibouti, Africa, to see how it might have evolved and grown over time. But I'll never know. It's just something that I learned that I need to be a lot more deliberate in how I look at these different problems and thinking about second and third order effects moving forward.
So from that experience, how has that informed your choices as a FAO and recognizing, like you said before, that you haven't had your first assignment yet outside of IRT? But how do you think that experience made a difference for you as a FAO, whether it be in assignment choices or the way you interact with the partner nation or what you're studying there at Harvard?
I think one big takeaway is, and I remember having this conversation with the different senior leaders over with Mission Mexico, is realizing that the DoD is not always going to be the solution for every country's problems. And knowing that you're supporting effort in regards to promoting U.S. interests abroad and going from a community where you're typically the tip of the spear and you're the priority of receiving all the assets and making sure you have everything you need to be successful, to now transitioning to more of a support role in promoting the U.S. interests and our strategic goals within the region. I think Djibouti, Africa is one of those great examples where I realized that tactical solutions are not always the best solutions. And when we were traveling, a lot of things that we would ask is we would really consider what would be the impact that we would make? What kind of things will we do to promote U.S. interests? And is this a mission set where we think that we can make a great impact and also do so without necessarily like compromising like the long-term interests in regards to the country's stability or even the U.S. interests over time? But when we started doing our travels, we wanted to visit countries where we knew that we had a good relationship. The military was definitely on board with the right things. And we took a very holistic approach of knowing what is the right environment where we can make a more holistic impact.
And do you feel like you met that?
Yeah, I think we're both really excited about our next assignment of going over and supporting Mission Panama. Panama is definitely an awesome partner. And there was a lot of countries that we visited where we were trying to think about what type of impact we would make in regards to supporting, it's either serving as an assistant Army section chief and what portfolio of programs we would be falling in on. And I think when we went to visit Panama and we're looking at not just the geostrategic interests of that country, but also how this touches on so many different things that are important to the region, we knew that this would be a great assignment for us to look at.
I specifically remember my IRT trip to Panama. The strategic importance of that country for the United States is just incredible, especially with Panama Canal there. And I wish I could remember the assistant Army attaché that was there, but I liked what he did with us IRT officers that were there on a visit. He said, look, I could sit you down and we could talk about the assignments you should choose and the things that you should do as a FAO, and we could tell stories. But here's what we're going to do instead. I want you guys to sit down in pairs and come up with strategic problems that we could face with the Panama Canal closing. Or how would somebody who opposes us in the region try to take advantage of our current politics, economy, world situation to try and push us out in Panama. And so we worked amongst each other, and he would talk with us, went back and forth with us on this subject. And it really got us to think about Panama in a different way, rather than just the canal, the city, the food, the embassy, what the partner's like. But it really forced us to take a strategic view of Panama during that trip and look at it in a much different way than I think we all came prepared for. So I absolutely agree. I think Panama is a strategically important partner for us. And personally think that you guys are going to do fantastic things down there for the team in Panama. I wanted to take a step back a little bit and talk about your experience in HRC. Now, I know that you were there as the manager for infantry lieutenants at the time. But I just want to ask maybe a quick question. Is there anything from your experience at that time or things that you've seen during your time at HRC that are worth knowing as a FAO? And the reason I'm asking that question is I know you and I talked a bunch about different situations with promotions, evaluations, assignments, and things that most officers aren't going to know about, stuff that maybe someone who's HRC would know about, but most guys aren't. Does anything come to mind about, hey, everybody should know this when dealing with HRC or when talking about assignments, evals, promotions, whatever it is?
I think for officers that are interested in sessions into FAO, I think it's important that they understand how the in and out charts work and understand like what their current branch's strength is. And I think this is pretty important. Like whenever I think about Signal Branch, for example, and the huge tax they pay to support other functional areas like the network system engineers, et cetera, certain branches have a higher demand of officers to support other functional areas. And so their window for them to apply to the FAO community is going to be a lot more limited compared to other branches, other combat arms branches. So I think that's one thing that I think is really important is for officers that are considering the transition over to FAO, is for them to know their year group, be aware of what their branch's strength looks like, and then pay attention to those annually submitted in and out charts that come with every single VTIP cycle so that they can have a better idea of what's the right time for them to transition over. Because there's a lot of officers that kind of wait too late. It's not necessarily that FAO isn't hiring for their year group. It's just that their branch can't release them because they need to maintain a certain number of officers within their own ranks for them to fulfill their mission elsewhere. So that would be something that I would definitely recommend to officers that are considering transitioning over. Another aspect is understanding how the VTIP panel works and knowing that it's not just FAO branch's call, but it's also a panel of different senior leaders within the HRC community that look at all these different applicants, and they want to make sure that there's a good equitable distribution across the force. So when officers are designing and coming up with their packet and the packets that different officers have sent me and asked me for feedback on, I've always promoted this narrative that the members who are sitting on that panel and that first vote before it even gets over to the FAO branch, they may dedicate 30 to 45 seconds on your packet. So you need to be very upfront and very clear and articulate why you think you'd be a good fit for this community. And you need to speak to the KSBs that the FAO branch is looking for that also complement your past performance as well. So understanding how that panel process works is very helpful so that people can use that information to structure their documents as effectively as possible. The other thing is every officer is still learning how the marketplace works. I know that we've gone through several markets now, and officers are starting to figure out what is the best strategies for them to maximize their competitiveness in the market. But there's a lot of technical details that I think are very important. And something that we've discussed, Mike, is the importance of preferencing all the jobs in the market and understanding how that signals interest to the organizations that you want to look at. Last I checked, whenever I was still working there, it's either your top three jobs or your top 10% that sends that signal to the hiring agency that you're interested in going there. So if officers are not preferencing all the assignments, even if they would be ecstatic about going to any of their top 10 assignments, if they only preference 10 or 15, they may only be communicating to their top three or locations that this is where I want to go. And that can limit some of those interview opportunities. So understanding how the market works, understanding how those systems work, and making sure that you sit in on all the educational lectures that Theo Branch offers to navigate that marketplace is really huge. But the one thing that I think I'm a big fan of with ATAP, and I think that Theo Branch does an incredible job of kind of capturing the spirit of it, is using references and relying on your network and the credibility that you build with other leaders that you work for to help market you to be competitive for the next assignment. And I think that a lot of FAOs that are just starting their career and haven't had the chance to develop their network, they've gone from a really well-established network that they may have developed in their original base branch to suddenly being an unknown figure within the FAO community. They have to develop that network very quickly, especially if they want to be competitive in their first marketplace. So understanding how those relationships work and finding mentors or leaders who can advocate on their behalf and are willing to reach out to other senior FAOs that are hiring for country team assignments and say, hey, you don't know this guy, but he's been working for me for X many months. I think he's going to be a phenomenal foreign area officer. And I think he would be a good fit for your team if you're looking for someone junior who has a hard work ethic. And I think he can contribute a lot to your organization.
Thank you for running that down. And I'm sure FAO Branch will also give you some likes and some high fives next time they see you for plugging their thing. They frequently come back to is, like you said, preference all the jobs in the market. I think that's something that we're all starting to get used to now, but it really is so important to preference those jobs and then seek out interviews. And the first market I was in, I didn't really quite understand the importance of the interview process, but now having done it two or three times, it's definitely now the most important thing you do during your next assignment cycle is seek out those interviews, request the interviews, and then prepare yourself to do those interviews. Thank you for putting that out and for sharing that. And you brought up something that you had talked about a little bit with reaching out to people and asking them to speak on your behalf. So that tells me that you have done a lot over the past couple of years to develop a good network within your FAO cohort and with some of the senior leaders we have in the region. So what is your process for seeking out mentors or in some cases mentees? How do you approach that?
Mentors is pretty interesting. I think the year of in-region training is definitely the best opportunity to do it because while you're traveling and you're coordinating with each country team to try to schedule a visit, something that I thought was a pretty significant acknowledgement from Major Curtis whenever we're working over in Mission Mexico was to treat every engagement that you have with a FAO while you're traveling as a potential job interview. And so there's a lot of preparation that takes place to make sure that you know what are the right questions to ask and make sure that you have a good understanding of the country team that you're going to visit so that you can leave a positive impact. But one, I think doing the preparation to make sure that you're representing yourself well as a potential hire down the road, I think that's one step. But I think the second thing is always follow up with every leader that you come across. And that could be something very subliminal as a quick email saying, hey, I really appreciate you taking the time to meet with me. I learned a lot. Here are the key takeaways. If there's something that I thought that you think is really profound that you didn't have time to dig into deeper, that's a great opportunity for you to reach out and say, this is something that you talked about. We didn't have a whole lot of time to discuss it, but I think this is really fascinating. Would you be able to tell me a little bit more about this? Or can I schedule a phone call to follow up to discuss this in greater depth? And when you're meeting with all these different senior leaders, you quickly figure out which senior leaders have expertise in different areas and who you want to stay in contact with in regards to different things. And you'll find different senior FAOs that you think are going to be great career mentors. Some senior FAOs that are going to be better advisors on familial concerns. I don't think any mentees are going to reach out to me and ask me about recommendations for schooling for kids. But you figure out like, who do you think can offer you the best advice on different things? So that would be one. I would say that would probably be the process that I think is most effective to establish a mentor relationship. And as you have more correspondence with these individuals, you'll want to reach out to them more frequently. But the other thing too is being able to offer something in return. And sometimes that's going to be very minimal, but if a senior FAO is working with a younger FAO and he's trying to help him onboard into the FAO community, he may be 10 or 12 years removed from the VTIP process and have no idea what that looks like. But being willing to offer your services on something that you just recently went through and say, hey, sir, I would be honored to help him out or talk him through this. you're expanding his network and his capabilities, and you're also offering something to that relationship to show your appreciation for his time and to continue to be value added. So I think that's the second part of developing a mentor relationship is being able to offer something to that senior leader that can make this relationship more reciprocal. Now, seeking out mentees, I think they just fall in your lap. A lot of them reach out to you whenever they have questions or concerns. And what I've made an effort of doing is anytime a young FAO or somebody who's interested in joining the FAO community wants to reach out for feedback, because I just try to be as useful as I possibly can and explain to them everything that I wish I would have known and help give them sound advice to reach whatever their goals are. And the same thing as you work with them and help them accomplish their goals, whenever you have another officer who reaches out to you in the future, like for example, FAO Branch just started an interview process part of their VTIP application. That was something that's new and unique for me, but I was able to put in contact a FAO that I'm working with, someone I previously worked with who went through the VTIP process and can talk a little bit more about the interview and being able to network other upcoming FAOs within the community with people who probably are going to be more aligned with his cohort, I think is a great strength within the branch.
What you said there about putting people together is probably one of the most important aspects of building that network and also being able to find and share mentees. This reminds me of something I read in a book by a guy named Dave Logan on tribal leadership. He talks about building what he calls triads. And the important thing is the people who are really successful at building networks don't build their own networks. They build other people's networks. It's finding someone that you know and then introducing that person to somebody else that you know and say, hey, you need to meet this person. When you're building other people's networks, it pays forward instead of backwards. You're building their network at the same time you're building value within your own network, and they'll start doing the same things for you. I've had some great mentors in the time that I've been around. I wanted to give a special shout out to Colonel Chike Williams, Colonel Dan Fitch, Colonel Chip Nolan, Lieutenant Colonel Jason Morales, and also Colonel Eric Bauer, who have all been great mentors for me. And they have helped me make good decisions and the right decisions and really expanded my understanding and focus to be doing the right things. And they've really helped me get to the place that I am today. So I 100% agree with you that mentorship is one of the most important things we do as FAOs. One thing I think a lot of people find in their own experience is that they haven't taken the time to reach out or to develop those relationships where they've been before, and they really don't know who to reach out to now. Matt, have you ever tried to cold call someone you've never met before and say, hey, I would like some mentorship? Has that ever worked out for you?
Yeah, it's terrifying, but senior leaders don't bite. They're excited. They're really excited to be helpful and help you navigate a process. And
right.
I think whenever I was applying for the DAS market, Carl Lopez put me in contact with a lot of senior leaders over in DIA and told me, hey, you need to contact these guys. And he helped me the same way you talked about expanding somebody's network. He would send out an email introduction and say, hey, Matt's a member of the team here. I think he would be a great addition to the DIA community. I just want to share with him your contact information because I think you guys would have a really productive conversation. I know that's not quite the same as cold calling, but scheduling an opportunity to call someone out the blue or reach out to them. For the most part, everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time and has the same challenges that you deal with. They just have a little bit more experience dealing with them. So it's really helpful to get that context of things that they've gone through and use that to your advantage as well.
There's a lot to be said about finding and making use of mentors. And I don't think we could talk enough about that. And something that I really wanted to focus on is how people have used them, how they've been helpful, and how you can find and develop those relationships. It's hard enough to be a senior captain, a young major, and reach out to an 06 cold call them, or even being introduced to them, having no background with that person to reach out for mentorship. But really, these officers are looking for people to work with because they know the importance of bringing up the next generation of foreign area officers in the right way. And I think that's what's most important about it, is because they've been around and they know how to help those FAOs reach their potential. So Matt, Maddie, we've had a sort of around the world discussion here today. I want to ask, Maddie, is there anything else that you'd like to put out or say, or a message that maybe you'd want to send to all military FAO spouses across the world?
Shouting out to all military FAO spouses.
You represent all of them for the
next every single one. 35 minutes. Actually, it was really funny because what I was about to say speaks towards that. I feel like every FAO family is unique and different. I mentioned earlier, we don't have kids. And we won't. That's not something that is or will be a part of our life. We have friends who have 4, 5, 6 kids and are living as Latin American FAOs. We went to 19 countries and we have good friends who maybe only will go to a handful. I think something that I said earlier was there are pros and cons to everything. There are highs and lows to everything. I think military spouses know that well. But I guess what I don't know how to put it. I like the idea of being inspirational with our story, but I do know that we have been lucky a lot along the way, that we've worked hard for everything that we have, but a lot of things in our life attribute to our opportunity. Being financially stable enabled me to be able to take a sabbatical. Being a clinical professional and not having children allowed us to easily move throughout the MEL-4 pipeline into IRT, travel full time, not need to manipulate our timeline to have consistency for schools or whatever else people like to have stability for. We like being nomadic. We own 5 possessions and we move every year happily. While this fits our lifestyle really well, I know that probably sounds like literally the worst possible thing for some people, and that's valid and okay too. It doesn't sound like your wife would like that very much. Let's just move every year and whatever.
There have been some times we've done exactly that, and ironically, well, she feels better traveling when we get to have a house and be permanent for a while. But I know she does like a little bit of permanence.
Sure. And I'm like, we could just live in a travel trailer with our 5 cups and travel the world with our dogs and be perfectly fine. It was really funny. When we were living in Mexico, we had embassy assigned housing and we put on our housing profile, we would be happy with 1 bedroom, 1 bath, a loft or a studio or something. And embassy housing doesn't exist like that because they're supporting families and they're in very specific neighborhoods that don't really have things like that. So we ended up with a 4-bedroom, 5-bathroom palace. But like I said, we don't own anything. We live a minimalist lifestyle, and everyone who would come to our house would say, did you guys just move in? Nope, our house is, it would just live because there's nothing on the walls.
That implies no that we furniture. Moved in at all.
Yeah, exactly. Did you guys just move? Did your HHG already pick up? We're like, no, this is how our house has looked for 10 and a half months. It's just funny. We're interested to see what Panama brings for us, but we're currently in Boston in a 650 square foot apartment where all of our things fit perfectly. I think that probably won't last very long either.
So yeah, you talking there actually made me think of something else on the subject of mentorship. Oftentimes spouses could use a little bit of mentoring too from within this military FAO spouse community. Because
for sure.
It really is, like you talked about before, you're given an assignment and it's a black box. You have no idea what to do with that information. You don't know where to go. You don't know who to talk to. But I think there's a lot to be said for developing some mentorship within the spouse community as well. And I know I don't want to name names, but I know there are a lot of spouses out there that are ready and willing to accept a call from anyone with any question about what it like being either in a specific country, region, or just in the program itself.
There was this actually really interesting program going on. I don't know if it's still there and going on, but when we were going through JFAAC and DLI in Monterey, they had this monthly senior FAO spouses meetup where from all branches, all the branches, and they hosted it in one of the rooms on base or something like that. And it was very accessible and it was late at night. So moms could go after they put their kids down and working spouses could go after they finished working. And it was 4 or 5 senior FAO spouses that I would say, saying senior FAO would be that they had gone to 2 or 3 post IRT assignments already. So they had been around. And they also represented a lot of the different regions as well. And it was open forum. What do you guys want to talk about? Who has questions about whatever? And it was also a really great networking opportunity too, because you would hear someone say, oh, we just got orders to Guatemala. And I was like, oh, we live in Mexico and we'll be visiting Guatemala. It just created a really great network, but also a sounding board for people who know nothing to people who know slightly more. But if it was a more widespread network for something like that, obviously there was a huge interest in that where we were. But I know that kind of once you leave that environment, then that opportunity goes away as well.
There are a lot of opportunities, and the density of FAO spouses and FAOs in general at DLI, and then when you bring the JFAOC in, it does create a really great opportunity to start that mentorship process for some of the spouses and for the young FAO officers as well.
Yeah. I think a piece of advice I would have to that vein is just to be involved in whatever capacity you can, whether that is attending DLI or just going to the senior FAO thing afterwards, or whether that's like being the CLO or going to a CLO coffee, like both of those things are important, or whether it's traveling to 19 countries with your spouse or like going on a road trip in your host nation. All of those things are cool experiences and fun and contribute to, I think, the overall FAO mission really well.
Thank you for sharing that, and appreciate everything you're doing as a spouse, supporting Matt and his decision and his travels. You're going to have more travels coming up, so I hope you're not too sad about that.
Probably not.
Probably not. Matt, and any last words from you? Anything that you'd like to share or any shout outs you want to make?
No, something that Maddie was talking about of being lucky is I realized that we had the opportunity for us to structure our MEL4 pipeline to be what we wanted. And we knew that it was going to be a little bit harder planning a sequential PCS every year. But that's what we wanted to do so that we could, one, do IRT before our market. And I know a lot of families, that's not a realistic consideration.
Right.
So everything comes with trade-offs. And I don't think necessarily like what we did is going to work for everybody. I think it works for two people who have time to commit themselves to this full IRT experience and who are willing to do this and have a minimalistic lifestyle so that it's not as burdensome to the PCS every year. We also have other colleagues that needed to stabilize a little bit longer in one area because they have family matters that they need to take care of. And I think all those things are important. So it's finding the right balance between your career and family. And that also applies to your MEL4 pipeline as well.
You and I talked previously about how the MEL4 pipeline is and how it works and also how it's developing. There's a lot of changes that we could make to the system. The question is always, how is that going to affect the preparation of FAOs to do the job? And how is that going to affect how we get them out into the world? It'll be interesting to see how the MEL4 pipeline grows and develops and changes over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I hope there's a great balance of allowing officers who want to have these unique experiences and really capitalize on the value that comes from planning your own trips and shaping your experiences. But I think there's a lot of value that would be added by having a little bit more organizational structure as well. I think like you had the exact same budget whenever you did your IRT. And I know that hasn't changed in probably like a decade or even longer.
Right.
But we have to be like really economic with resources and how we can maximize the return on the training investment. For someone who wants to replicate something that we did, like we had to be willing for us to commit a lot of our own resources for us to have those experiences. And I think there's some great benefits that would take place by having a mix of individual planning goes also with organizational structure within the MEL4 pipeline.
Are there any changes that you think could be worthwhile to that pipeline, whether IRT, ACS, ILE? I ask, as you mentioned, changing the structure of IRT to be a little bit more centralized. How do you envision that, and what do you think would be a good solution?
So some of the things that we talked about is a lot of countries that I think are really important for us to see are also some of the busiest countries as well. It's difficult to get on their schedule. And you typically need a pretty robust group for you to go visit these particular countries. So that I think Proponent can definitely assist as well as providing like here's the robust itinerary for these key countries that everybody needs to see. Everybody needs to go to Brazil, Mexico, Colombia. So I think that there's some structural design in which a country Proponent can prescribe, hey, here's the visiting windows that we've already coordinated with the country teams. And I think mixing that with individual travel that each officer is able to plan for him to go see these other smaller countries, especially as for those countries that have job opportunities that are lining up with their market, I think that would be a great benefit.
A good point.
In regards to like which step is most important, like when should you do IRT, when should you go to grad school, et cetera, I know a lot of that kind of pertains to your family situation. And I know there's a lot of value of staying in Monterey a little bit longer for you to go to MPS and so on. But with how the market and how ATAP's influencing assignments, based off our conversations of messaging and building your network, there's a lot of value of going out and doing IRT first before your market and establishing those networks so that you can be as competitive as possible for your market. The other thing that I thought was really helpful is, especially in grad school now, is I have a better idea of what questions, which subjects I really want to delve into deeper based off my IRT experience. And you're a lot more informed of particular challenges of each region, and you know exactly what are the things that you really want to dig into. And it's also fun being able to cite yourself on your IRT reports that you send up to Proponent. That's fun. And being able to reach back out to the members on econ team for Guatemala or different countries to say, hey, we spoke a couple months ago. I have a few questions I wanted to ask for this paper that I'm working on. So there's a lot of benefits of developing that network going into your graduate studies as well.
Yeah, you're not kidding. Well, Matt and Maddie, we've had a pretty wide-ranging conversation today. And I just wanted to say thank you again for coming on and sharing your story. And I look forward to seeing you again soon downrange.